Hello and welcome to 251. Two pianists, five questions, one guest. My name's Simon Whiteside.
And my name's Nick Tomlin. And our guest today is Seb Scotney, who's perhaps best known for the London Jazz News website, which I think we're going to be talking about today. So, Seb, thanks very much for agreeing to do this. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the history of the website, sort of how the idea came and how you went about setting it up, etc.
Yes, so well, it's lovely to be here. I mean, the backstory is that I tried a couple of other things to find a role in music that would work for me after having had another career, and the first one that was a thing called the Jazz Development Trust, which was the thing that had been set up by the Dankworths as a kind of marketing organisation for jazz, but they really had no money and Jazz Services didn't really want it around. So I'd kind of got to know the community through that. And I think also, I mean, I'd been on those Glamorgan summer schools I'd got to know some of the best of the community and that feeling through that. And I'd had a year, I thought I was going to go in a different direction. I had a year doing kind of professional development, career advice, letting people try things at the Royal College of Music, but that came to a sudden stop. I think I was probably countercultural in a conservatoire, it wasn't going to work. And then on one Saturday afternoon in January 2009, I just started up a blog. And I remember, I mean, the first piece I ever wrote was previewing the Ian Shaw residency at Pizza Express and just telling people that you had to hear Leanne because Leanne was one of the wonders of the world. And that kind of set a tone of just previewing things. And that's now January 2009 and we're now in March 22. So this is 13 years ago and it's kind of grown. And it's almost unrecognisable from the one-person blog as which it started in what we do now. And also, I think, I mean, I like to learn along the way. I like to try things along the way. And it's never quite the same. I mean, the thing that we've been fairly consistent about is sending out at 8 o'clock every Wednesday morning a newsletter. I mean, we've done a number of things that people have found it quite easy to copy. I like to sort of try things out. And you know, if it works, then and it's not too hard to copy, people will copy it. That's just the way of the world. But the Wednesday morning thing, I mean, my week is kind of dominated. We're talking on a Wednesday, and so Monday and Tuesday with the team has been putting together our Wednesday newsletter. And that that idea that you have a moment when you're just putting all your stuff on the table, and we basically aggregate news from other sources. I mean, that has an origin, and in my previous career, I used to be an expert on the Belgian stock market, and we used to send out a daily fax in the days of fax machines mostly through the 90s, and that was basically aggregating all the stories that we knew investors would be interested to do with Belgium. So that was their kind of one-stop shop, and the London Jazz News Wednesday breakfast headlines is a distant cousin of a Belgian daily stock market fax.
Well, that's how I feel reading it. I feel like I'm learning a lot about Belgium.
Will you leave, please?
that's interesting. And around that time, so 2009, did you have a look at what else was around in terms of sort of online jazz content?
I just set up a blog that was going to reflect my enthusiasms. It's always been an important thing that the previewing is actually of more value in improvised music than the reviewing, in the sense that somebody who's got some kind of musical ears explaining why people might want to go to a gig from their knowledge of the subject and from their enthusiasm for the subject is, to me, something of value. I mean, I always note that in the sports pages, the write-ups of games are kind of filed within a few hours of the game, and most of the week you're looking forward. And that, I think, is a good way to live, is to explain to people who've got some kind of interest or are going to be dragged along to the gig anyway, why they might want to be there. And I think, you know, I mean, there are people, I've sat in concert halls where people have explained, you know, the kind of mansplainers or whatever they are, who explain to people what they're going to hear and why they're, and a lot of the time it's gossip, and a lot of the time it's got absolutely nothing to do with the music. It's just kind of, it's not helpful, you know, to know about performers' private lives when you're about to hear them play. I mean, it's something. So I'm interested in, musically literate previewing, I think, was something that I was always interested to do. I mean, a survey of the marketplace, I mean, I think I wanted to do it my way. I mean, the most, you know, people look back, when you look back, and I'm not quite sure at what point it was. It was sometime before I did it, though. I always remember the great Alan Bates of the Candid label. Basically, when I was running that thing, the Jazz Development Trust, he gave me the best piece of advice, or the only good piece of advice I think I've had, which was basically, until you've done your own thing, nobody's going to really know who you are. And that was what really struck a chord, was actually, you know, you're going to be doing things instinctively in a way that you want to do them, but you know, using the resources that you've got and the knowledge that you've got and the enthusiasm that you've got, and that's going to drive you, you know. And so what that means is that it's going to reflect what I write is going to reflect my interests and prejudices and enthusiasm. And what I gradually have done is to find people with different interests and enthusiasms, and to broaden out the scope. So and that what I think also what gives us is a sense that, you know, it's going to be the next piece that appears won't necessarily be what you expect it to appear. And I think when people tell us that we've, you know, that's the breadth of it, that's what I like, you know. And we've got, you know, we've had people who've come along and worked at different times, and it's the character of that is changing, because people will find themselves busy, people will find themselves they haven't got the time to contribute much, and then they might come back again, you know. So that's that. What was the question?
I think it's interesting how, because one of the things I always find odd about reviews of concerts, and particularly with jazz concerts, is because, you know, I'm telling you what you've missed, and it's different with a theatre review, because it's on every night. But when it's a gig, it's like, well, Quentin Collins is playing at the 606, for example. If you describe the gig after the event, you're not really helping anyone much. Perhaps the band to sell a few CDs or something. But if you're describing what people might expect to hear from that band before they go, then it's almost like an invite rather than a postscript.
Absolutely. And I think that has kind of, I've developed that idea, and it's led me into some interesting situations. I mean, one of the advantages that I've got coming into this is that I have pretty good European languages, French and German and a bit of Dutch, and I have ended up doing a lot of kind of sleeve notes and press releases for labels on the continent. And actually, to capture the essence of what a musician is about in a way that they recognise, is I find that really the most interesting challenge, really. And, you know, we've just done, literally this week, on the week of this recording, a series of profiles for International Women's Day that we've been doing since 2011. And one of them is a wonderful saxophone player called Rachel Cohen that I wrote. And I just thought, you know, she's been, you know, she's now mid-30s. She's been kind of growing as a musician ever since. She carries incredible enthusiasm and joy around with her when whatever she does. And that story has, in a way, never been told. And so I kind of took it upon myself and, you know, did some picked up pieces, people who taught her and people who've played with her, and kind of to get a full kind of portrait together. Because, you know, she's been, you know, the pigeonholing of Rachel is something like, made album at the age of 26, sort of vaguely sounded like Lee Konitz, end of. And there is something there. I mean, number one, it's out of date. Number two, it's not accurate. And number three, there is a wonderful personality there that I wanted to see. And so, I mean, if that, to me, if you can actually fill in an interesting story about a musician. And as you know, as a writer, one can do this in a way that then reflects it so that people who don't know that musician will have a bit more to work with. Mm. I mean, it's always the case that when people are being promoted by bigger labels and that whole kind of infrastructure and of press relations and things is there, it happens with you know, it's already there, the bits are already in place. But at the level of, you know, the musicians that are occupying our clubs, that story doesn't always get told, you know. I mean, and that goes up to and including people like Ian Ballamy, that is a, you know, is people worship Ian Ballamy within this community, but, you know, and you know, to try and tell his story and how humorous he is and how what his musical interests are and that kind of thing. I mean, that to me is the work, you know, and I enjoy it.
Mm. I just wondered if you could give us an idea of what's kind of involved in producing and managing the content on a, you know, on a sort of day-to-day or weekly basis. What's that process? What does it kind of involve, really?
Well, I am not the most organised person. I'm very lucky to be surrounded by people who are really, who know exactly the tasks that they've got to do and do them. So there is a team around me of lovely people. We have, as I've mentioned, the newsletter is a major focus every week because it's almost like a separate product alongside the website, and it kind of performing a wider role than merely just drawing attention to our content, and that has a couple of people involved in it. That there's Rob Edgar, who had started with us as an intern, came for a week, stayed for about 2.5 years, and is still doing things for us. And he's just very fast at putting things, links down, and accurate putting links down on a page. So that's his, and he basically does all of the final inputting of the newsletter. So that's an important role.
How do you distribute it?
MailChimp.
You use MailChimp, right? Yeah.
We also have another. The top section is prize draws, and those are normally part of a marketing package. So I have another colleague who's called Romy Summers, who was on the marketing team at Cadogan Hall before she had children, and she is our advertising manager, and she is absolutely brilliant at scheduling, both from the kind of instinctive way of when things should appear, because I think as an online publication we've got the advantage that we can basically put together a package which involves an advert on the site, a feature. And we have very often John Fordham or John Bungie, used to be with The Times, writing those features. We have Peter Bacon and Rob Adams, Alison Bentley, who's a wonderfully musically literate singer who writes. So people are writing these really high quality previews as part of the package. And then the prize draw for something is basically, that's our main marketing slot on the newsletter. And there is a charge. I mean, we don't think we're overcharging for it, and nobody's ever told us that we're overcharging for it, but it is basically if anybody is anywhere near one of our channels, then this is like a premium service. You know, I mean, it's they used to teach on the Sirius Take 5 course that all young musicians had to do was to ring me up and I'd do a preview, a profile of them. Which I then, you know, I suddenly got a whole raft of calls from young musicians saying, I'm told that if I just ring you up, you're going to do a profile of me. And I just said, well, yeah, really? You know, what we've done with these things is to make that into something for which, you know, in good years, we will cover all of the direct costs through those packages. And that's down to Romy. Who puts them together, schedules them, so basically, and at the end of the process, I see the invoices that go out, and it is, you know, the 8 or 9 things that she has done during the course of that period when they've been advertising with us, and that basically, you know, helps the story to be better understood, gives them our main marketing slot, puts an advert on the site. You know, we also do cross-channel. We've got over 50,000 Twitter followers, so it's on that as well. So that is all. That's all about scheduling. That's all about if there is a kind of a date where things are due to happen, then we can charge for it. And I, you know, there is no law out there that says that I have to do everything forever for everybody for absolutely nothing. And when I've got somebody of the quality of Romy, who is a complete delight to work with, working with me, then I'm really proud of what she does as a good service that we can provide.
So you're saying that so a record label will buy that slot, or a venue will buy it?
Yeah, or a musician, or it can be. And they can basically. I mean, we have a limited number of them at any time. I mean, we also have an advertising slot on the newsletter for people who get in touch with us 4 days before a gig, saying help. we'll do a bit more in those circumstances as well. But I think, you know, the main things, it's, you know, people can predict that they're going to be happening several months. And a lot of the time, if they've got grants for things, then they'll have a budget for publicity. And actually within that, we're going to probably be one of the smaller bits of it.
Yes. That's, I've been a couple of times to the MU how to get funding workshops, and they talk a lot about the making sure you put money aside for direct marketing of some form, whether it's getting flyers printed or contacting websites or hiring airtime on.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have an advantage in this context, which is that you can schedule everything precisely. That there is a right time to be informing people about things, and we can fit in with that, you know. And there's another, actually. We have a reviewer panel, and they get an email very early on a Monday morning from another wonderful colleague who's called Kate Ford, who's the sister of the drummer, Eric Ford.
Oh, yeah.
And Kate is very diligent, and for some reason she starts her week with putting out this newsletter, and it's like the idea of it is it's sort of feeding time at the sea lions. It's basically, here is what we've got on offer this week, come and grab it. And that generates a certain number of reviews where people just see stuff on this on this list. And she puts carefully puts sound clips and things next to everything so people can hear it. And that generates a certain number of views. And that also means that it becomes less a kind of personal, you know, the thing. I mean, what we're noticing increasingly is that there are strange rules for the monthly publications which are given by the bigger jazz labels, monster lead times in order to get stuff done. And sometimes we'll be to when you know, I mean, the publisher of Downbeat is a friend of mine. We have the same birthday. He's a bit younger than me. And we chat about these things. And I can see that they get told about releases on, for example, Blue Note, you know, in order that they can line up covers. These monthly publications get a special treatment. And, you know, we are sometimes told about releases 2 weeks ahead of time. And by which point you think, well, have I really, you know, is there somebody who's going to do it? And that's often to do with the head offices of the labels guarding those things. And also, I mean, the kind of the monthly publications are seen as a special cause for, you know, like an endangered species, and they're kind of looked after a bit.
Well, I guess also there's a history of that, isn't there? So Downbeat's been around for a long time, and therefore I remember there's a new notation software called Dorico out there, which I remember when it was being developed, one of the ex Sibelius people who had been fired when Avid bought them. And he said, Sibelius is great, but it's like when you ask the directions to Norwich and someone says, well, I wouldn't start from here. And I think with tradition, you can also, like, well, this is how we've always done it, so let's keep on doing it that way. Whereas when you've got new ways of reaching people, like a newsletter or direct marketing in other ways, you can be nimbler.
I think so. I mean, I have a lot of. I mean, Frank Elkir and I have a lovely conversation. I mean, I remember when I was there, I had a lunch with him after we'd been going for 10 years, and he basically told me that Downbeat hadn't made money in its first 30 or 40. You know, keep going, mate. Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's anyway. Next, are we on to the number?
Number are we on one? To?
Yeah.
Our third question is: do you have any personal highlights from your years of involvement with the site? Things that you've particularly felt might have made a difference, or that you've enjoyed personally? Or
well, I mean, I just sort of turn the... I mean, this we've talked a little bit about the Women's Day profiles that we've been doing for 12 years now. That's one. But I'm quite proud of what we do to celebrate musicians' birthdays. It's something... I mean, literally 2 days ago, I ran into Dave Green at Ronnie Scott's and we put together a series of birthday wishes for him. I mean, it starts with Guy Barker remembering the first time he walked onto a stand with Dave Green there. It includes Sonny Rollins and includes Dan Morgenstern from Rutgers University, which was one that particularly chuffed Dave Green to have that. And I think what I see... or what I want to see in this community and among the people that I admire is the respect, admiration, love and gratitude that does the rounds between very good musicians. And I mean, we've done them. We've done one for Mike Westbrook. We've done one for Henry Lowther. We've done one for Norma Winston. And as I say, there are some others as well that I'm sure that will come to light. Tony Haynes of the Grand Union Orchestra we did. But this one of Dave Green, you know, to encourage people who've known Dave Green at any point since the 60s, you know, I mean, Mark Thiemann, for example, was there, you know, and just to basically tell Dave why he is appreciated. And that it might look slightly over the top, but in the end, that is the commodity among musicians that I think I am happiest dealing with, and it was finding a way to make that come to light. I've seen instances where musicians, the press has undermined musicians for various reasons, and I'm not going to play that game. I think everybody, you know, is worthy of having their strong characteristics. I mean, as an amateur player, I've been on a bandstand, and the encouraging smile that you get from Dave Green walking onto a stand does set you up for the rest of the evening. I have experienced it myself. There was no reason why he should do that, but it's
I think it's nice as well that it's while they're still alive, you know, because I think very often, you know, a great musician dies and then people start to kind of, you know, you get the reminiscences, but it's nice that it's while somebody's alive that, you know, they get that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that so strongly. I mean, that's what I get. You know, the people who survive and thrive in this sector are very often characters like that. You know, I mean, the outpouring of love for Norma when she had her 80th towards the end of last year was a similar enterprise from that. I mean, another thing that we've done which is interesting, it's things of personal interest to me, which, I mean, we do a thing which is called 10 Tracks I Can't Live Without, that's a relatively recent thing. But what I've always been fascinated by is to get under the skin a little bit and to find out how individual musicians have been influenced and how that has taken care. I mean, you get that a lot. I mean, Ethan Iverson does it all the time, and his interviews go very, very deep.
Yeah.
I wanted a kind of quite condensed format.
Yeah.
The one of those that I think has really captured what I thought I was looking for was an American bass player called Richie Goods, who wrote one about Marcus Miller, and what he does there. I mean, he's clearly kind of just worked out exactly what innovations, album by album, Marcus Miller has been doing. You know, that deep sense of one bass player just, you know, that's what you're doing, you know. And Richie Goods conveys that extremely well. So I quite like that as a series, you know. I mean, what started off, I remember once reading an interview where Ron Carter was describing the contribution of Ray Brown to the bass. And actually, if you read it, it more or less tells you what to listen out for in Ron Carter's own playing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it's about. It's when you hear, I mean, there's an interview where Robert Glasper talks about Herbie, and that's a similar idea that, you know, it more or less it tells you the things that what the musician themselves value about what they do themselves as through the prism of their respect, gratitude, admiration for someone else. So that to me is capturing that. There are probably, I mean, I have a pretty charmed life. Number one, the seat that I kind of occupy is somewhere where most people are going to show you their very best side most of the time. And actually that is a very lucky position to be in. You know, I'm not booking or unbooking musicians for gigs, which is a different kind of enterprise and creates different emotions. What this is about is actually normally holding up a positive mirror to people. And, you know, I mean, it has led me into some really nice situations. I mean, I feel totally blessed to have been invited for 6 years on the trot to the Montreal Festival and to get to know that city in the summertime, which has just been glorious. I've gone down to Cape Town, you know. I am unbelievably lucky in what I do, and I don't. And also, I mean, just some of the gigs that I've been to, some of the experiences that I've had, some of the people that I've met through it. I did an interview with George Cables. And there is somebody from whom goodness and only goodness flows. He is just a delightful. I kind of had a form set because I knew I had limited time. The interview had been set for between his sound check and having supper before the gig, and so we had limited time, and he just got exactly what it was about and just basically delivered an interview straight off. And that is, I'll always hold that up as being a, you know, one of the happiest times like one could spend, because he is a very special, I mean, when you think of all the illnesses that he's had and all of the troubles, you know, the spirit there is just goodness flows. That's the only way I can describe it, really.
Excellent. There's, I guess, meeting people from all different areas of jazz is brings an overview as well that gives a lot to the newsletter and the website.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, you end up working well with people you find you can work in a harmonious way with, and there are some people who make that easier than others do. It's kind of.
So, I mean, how involved are you with the site? I mean, what are your kind of day to day responsibilities with regard to running it now?
Well, the way that I look at that is that we've got getting on for 12,000 articles sitting out there in the public domain at any point of any day or night. Somebody can decide to create a controversy or a row about any phrase there. And I have the natural instinct to avoid that kind of conflict. And therefore, I mean, it's a responsibility that I take for what is there. You know, we have had an extraordinary incident where a photographer has challenged us through a lawyer for use of a picture after 11 years with no prior warning. And so kind of getting sensible legal advice to protect one in those kind of circumstances, trying to I if I have interns, I make it absolutely clear to them, and we have a brilliant one at the moment, actually, the responsibilities that down to me, and that if there is something that I haven't spotted, then as far as I'm concerned, being an intern is a mistake-free zone. It's up to us to spot if things are factually inaccurate or liable to give rise to somebody starting a row. We had an incident with the publisher of another magazine who basically who put in a comment saying that there was something rather important that was missing in one of our pieces, and then I didn't publish it. I just thought he's got his own outlets to publish things, and sure enough, he produced a 1600 word essay on why we'd got it wrong, and that's his problem. I'm not hosting those kind of spats. You know, there can be you know, I mean, it's unbelievable how people, I mean, how people can suck the life out of things that have got such enthusiasm and such talent and such work at their heart to actually undermine. I'm not really bothered with it.
No, I mean, it's always easier to knock something down, isn't it, than build something up. That's the modern problem with social media, I think. It's just very easy to
pick at things. I suppose that's the simplest answer to your question, is that I think that's the main effort.
So you sort of have an overview of what's being put out and sort of...
I'm publisher, I'm responsible, I can see no other way. I mean, and, you know, touch wood, we've been... left alone in that regard, but you can never be confident. But it's, you know, it's trying to make sure, you know, particularly, I mean, photography credits these days, because you have these agencies that do image searches, and they don't even bother to contact you directly. They basically put it straight in the hands of a kind of a disaster chasing lawyer, who will then basically start billing you for stupid amounts of money. That's one that you just have to, you know, you've got to be careful. And also, I mean, you know, just the kind of the being fair to people, being, you know, smelling when things can lead to somebody, you know, clumsy writing that can that can lead to people just starting up a row. You know? There's a task there, which I think is to try and tell reliable, authentic stories, and that's actually, you know, I mean, if you go onto the website of Michael Volny, the German piano player, the English profile of him is something that I've written, you know, and the people there were very happy to kind of have his kind of creativity encapsulated in some decent writing. That's what motivates us. I'm now repeating myself. I mean, that does motivate me.
I think the interesting thing there is what I think you're saying is that there's a... I mean, speaking personally, I'll let Nick speak for himself, but I trust your newsletter. If I read your newsletter because I think I'm going to find something out that's interesting to me, and I trust it. And I think you build that by not being... in these sorts of fracas that you're carefully avoiding, if you like. It's when there's someone... a lot of places on the net are lawless, really. So when someone has a editorial hand on it, then it has a... I'm a big fan of Ted Gioia and his writing, because he does what he does. He's very open and honest about what it is he's doing and what he won't do. So he avoids taking, you know, if payment, backhanders, whatever you want to call them, from anybody to promote them. What he promotes is what he likes, and he's clear about that. So you know then that when you get his newsletter, it's going to be, it might not even be about, it's often not about music. It will be about, the last one was about him being on, he's had a friend who had a record shop underneath the building where Google started and Facebook, and it's a little place where like 20 people can work and various startups, and it's called something like the Lucky Building or something like that, because so many of the Twitter and all those sorts of companies started there with 20 people, and then when they got too big they have to move. And you know, those sorts of interesting things, you just trust his voice. And I think you do, I do, certainly do with London Jazz News.
You're very kind. I mean, I would say that when we are doing these promotional packages, we do always mark them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's another thing. Yes.
You know, that you're, you have to, I think, make it clear. For example, we occasionally get people who want to write for us who are actually marketing or promoting a gig. And I don't have a problem with that if it says underneath, if the interest is declared.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that because people who have an axe to grind in a particular way also have a voice, they're also people with their enthusiasms, and they're very often doing what they're doing because of those enthusiasms. And I don't want to lose those voices. And I think that if you basically put a it's not a disclaimer, it's a kind of just you know, here is why this piece is here, then that kind of deals with that.
And absolutely,
we haven't had a problem with that.
Mm. No, absolutely. And I think that's my point, is that it's not there's some advertising you get by the back door on some, you know, any website. I'm not talking about any particular music or anything like that. Where you're reading something, and it's halfway through, you think, hang on, this is an advert, not an article. Yeah. And I think you're always very clear about that. You know, we've had this record from Candide with the latest release from so-and-so, and it's very clear that that's what it is. You know, so.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, you're always, you know, there's always somebody who can try and deconstruct, and in general, I'm very pleased. Well, I'm very pleased that you find that to be the case, and that's because that's what we would ideally want to be doing. You know, I mean, it becomes a strange thing. I mean, for example, I do a lot of translation for the Jazz Ahead conference.
Oh, yeah.
So their press releases. So often, I will know that their press releases are coming, I can basically give publicity to that, because I just have, I mean, if I've translated it, then they might as well have it, you know.
Yeah.
It's the only time I've ever written for Jazzwise was that the Jazzwise once took verbatim a press release that I'd written. So I have, although uncredited, have appeared in Jazzwise.
Yeah, well, the last question really was just, you know, you've got quite a unique perspective on the kind of the jazz scene in the UK, having been at the forefront of this website. You know, we just wondered, two questions really. I suppose they're quite big questions really. One is, you know, do you have any sort of views on just how jazz has developed since 2009, since you've been publishing this? You know, have you seen any sort of trends in the jazz scene, and also what are your thoughts for the future really of UK jazz? I mean, that's a huge question, but
bust off that crystal ball.
What I try and portray, I think, is the breadth of the scene. We are, you know, constantly, we deal with this phenomenon of the Southeast London scene. And the kind of the scale of the exposure that is getting, and try and reflect that as well alongside other things that are going on.
Do you mean the jazz renaissance kind of?
The Kokoroko, Nubagas,
Shabaka,
and this kind of. Yeah. I mean, there has been a story which has been kind of iterated many times about this, and they are. They are reaching high profile and a broader thing. I see the scene as being broader than that, I'm determined to kind of reflect wider wider perspective. And you know, I mean, everybody is doing different. I mean, place that we're in at the moment, just kind of emerging from the pandemic, is the extent to which I've been talking to promoters about how people are still reluctant to some extent to get out. People have found other ways of consuming music and all of that. Being a jazz musician in this country has never been easy, and it is a I sort of set my stall by just trying to ensure that as many we can kind of draw attention to and explain and narrate as many parts of it as we can. And that's, I think, you know, I mean, I've given you an idea of the sense of kind of responsibility in terms of editorial responsibility. You know, I kind of instinctively rebel against the idea that because something is on a label of renown that it has intrinsic interest in it. We end up, as I say, we have good relationships with some publicists and some labels, and appalling relationships with others. And, you know, that's always going to be, you know, one will end up working with the people one wants to work. I don't know. I mean, I find it very hard to generalize in that way. I think there's a mentality that people are going to be doing what they do, and they'll make it happen. I think of characters like Nigel Price, yeah, or Michael Janish, Sam Spilett. There are people who basically take an entrepreneurial approach to getting their music out there, and there's a kind of indomitable spirit there. I'm going to be talking in about, after we finish, to Tim Garland about something that he's doing, you know, and I just that kind of creative stroke entrepreneurial spirit, basically not waiting for things to happen, not waiting for approval, is a hallmark of the scene, really.
And also, I mean, I always think of a sort of stubbornness in a way. It takes a kind of a stubbornness just to say, I'm going to do this, whatever, you know, however hard it is or whatever, I'm just going to do it. And I think that's kind of, you know, that there's also an element of that in it, I think, as well.
Absolutely. I mean, in their different ways. Mm. I mean, I suppose, you know, I mean, I have the direct comparisons of the way that the structures work in France and in the German-speaking world, and can see the differences as to how musicians are treated there, how the community, the different ways in which those communities are either joined up or receive public subsidy, and to have, because through the languages that I've got and through the kind of openness to that, I can see different ways. I mean, the French scene, you know, I know the you know, they have a drive time show 5 days a week, that's just after 6 o'clock for their local time, and that as a kind of shop window for their scene and for the international scene is unbelievable. And the guy who does it is absolutely brilliant, Alex Dutille. And he basically threads through these programs with a narrative. It's very classily done from top to bottom. And my joy is when I see a press release I've written in English, then turned into beautiful French and put up on their website. You know,
and is that a state?
It's the state broadcaster, but the structures go deeper than that. I mean, they have the booking. I mean, they still have a system there which is called Les Intermittents du Spectacle, which means that if you're in a live performance based thing, you can actually step every month into the social security net, and you can and that includes people like bookers and agents. So you've got an infrastructure there of people who are promoting. And also, I mean, I go to the annual meeting of what's called AJC, which is the Festivals Collective in France. And they have bands that they promote, 4 bands every year, who are basically guaranteed bookings by the festival promoters in their network. And that is basically in receipt of subsidy as well. I mean, we don't have that kind of joined upness. We don't have a scene that supports itself. I mean, when I think of what I've just done with this profile of Rachel Cohen, she would not have got to the stage that she's got to without having probably an album every couple of years, a player of that quality. It wouldn't, if she'd been French, it would have been very different. And you have in Germany it's different because you have the regional structures.
Yes.
You know, that each of the lender is kind of vying with each other to, you know, look at us.
We've got better jazz. Ha-ha.
Well, that's in a way, and the Germans, you know, the Germans have an openness to our jazz. You know, I mean, the number of conversations I always get reported about the influence of John Taylor through his teaching in Germany is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was about to mention him actually, because I did speak to him about how do you make a living, and he said mostly in Germany, because the continental appreciation for the music is higher and more general. It's not connoisseurs. It's just people.
We all have conversations like that. I mean, I can't. I mean, and they were really interesting. The one that really intrigues me is that in Ireland and in Scotland, the kind of improvisers and the folk music thing, and the way that there is a kind of validation of improvisers, who are taking on the folk tradition there, and that strand in England has just never really happened. I mean, I saw Tony Woods the other night, and. And thinking about, I mean, and there are others, you know, when you have people like Nicky Isles and Pete Churchill, who've got that whole folk tradition, the Vaughan Williams, you know, John Ireland, and all that kind of background in them, and yet we never see that as legitimised in other countries. They'd be absolutely you know, I mean, as I say, I mean, not just in other countries, but in other parts of the British Isles, that is seen to be a worthwhile endeavour. Mm. And I just scratch my head as to how we've not, you know, that never gets kind of bitten on.
I mean, I think we've gone through waves of destruction of our art scene, and then that always has a long-term effect. So if you stop free music lessons at school for 10 years, for example, even if you start them again, by the end of the 10-year period, that's when you're going to start seeing the results of that. So you've got a 20-year period where basically not very many people have been having first-hand contact with music, and therefore they don't know music, just like if they'd not learnt any French. Or, you know, it's just a whole contact thing. Then you get to the end of that and someone says, well, I haven't really done the thing, so we'll cut it all again. And then it goes around again. And I think we've had several of those cycles in my lifetime where music has just been marginalised in education, really. And it's just not there on the table as something. Do you want to play the flute? Well, we've got some flutes. Have a go. You don't like it? Fine. You know, go and do some woodwork. That just doesn't happen anymore, really. It's very much, you know, it becomes very much a middle class thing, because there's the money there to have the flute lesson and then give it up, or the drum lesson, and it's not so broad as it could be sometimes.
Yeah, the way that I respond to that is to salute the energy and see when I see the people who are working against that, and the flair of people. One of my children went through the Centre for Young Musicians, London School Symphony Orchestra, and the kind of team around that. There's a woman in there called Chrissy Kinsella who runs the Mayor's Music Fund, and what she's done, you know, in terms of just fighting against those trends. Maybe in the end it's a drop in the ocean, but you know, it's kind of what we can do is to draw attention to those kind of good things. You know? And when you see how children can be energized by the right people getting involved in the sort of thing, it's inspiring, and you just want it to happen and want to kind of draw attention to it, you know. I will fight against the notion of a club and try and make this scene as welcoming as I can. It worries me sometimes that some of the there are fans who have such a way of sucking the life out of a subject, you know. I'm challenged sometimes to communicate with energy about it, because that's what it needs, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest thing for any, I mean, that's why we are embarking on these series of talks to people like yourself, because we have the interest in what is out there to promote music. There are plenty of interviews directly with musicians, but very few with people who enable musicians to do their thing. So we're very keen on that sort of spreading of the infrastructure around which jazz can thrive.
You're flattering me a lot. I mean, I just, you know, I what in a way what we do is what I can do is limited, and you know we do what we can, and I think like everybody else this fragmentation of the kind of landscape of media it has advantages and disadvantages.
Yes, well, no gatekeepers, but fewer gates, maybe, you know.
That was the last question. I mean, I'd always rather see myself as a gate opener than a gatekeeper. Exactly. I do a lot of introductions for people who I think are likely to get on with each other. I want a scene where you can build a sense of trust and teamwork around, which is at the heart of the music anyway, then that is something worthwhile to do. I don't want people to have kind of barriers to entry either. You mentioned the women, gatekeeper is quite an emotive word, but there are people who do look at it like that. You know, I think, for example, that 10 tracks I can't do without. The one that got done on Norma Winston was by a young singer who has been inspired by her, and we got a comment in from somebody saying that, you know, that she had appeared not to have mentioned the 1970s. You know, and I put in just a response saying that, you know, no damage has been done to any decades in the production of this piece. This is a personal selection by the musician concerned, and it's not supposed to be a best of list,
or a history or whatever.
But it's that there are these people who like it kept tight, and I don't believe that. I think I want more people to just feel, I take an example of, you know, people in my kind of extended family who ask for a recommendation, and I just send them something that I think they might enjoy listening to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, those nodes, I think, when I first left college, before I went to the National Film School, I was a bookseller, and I worked for Waterstones, and the mentality, when it was owned by Tim Waterstone, and the mentality there was that he wanted to employ graduates who read, so that when a customer came in, they would be a node. And, you know, obviously my interest was music, so anyone who asked about music books was sent my way. And, you know, you could, when you've got, it's a two-way street then. They say, oh, I really like Schumann. It's like, ah, now, you might like this then. And you pick up a book that is about Wolf or someone who's close but not quite, you know, or a new book that deals with, or there's a new fiction book which is about the life of Clara Schumann. Do you know that? You know, and that's because those people, in whatever area it was, mine happened to be music, but if you have nodes of people with knowledge, you will be able to connect people with things that allow them to grow.
I'm going to write down a book recommendation now. Okay. This is going to really work on radio, isn't it?
Yes. Seb is now writing something down in blue pen. And yes, we won't tell you what it is. You'll have to look on the website.
No, I mean, there's a particular book at the moment which is actually set in a conservatoire. And it has made quite a sensation about in the literary world. No music critic that I know has even heard of it. And it's all about the anxieties of an opera singing student in a location that can only be Guildhall,
right?
And as I say, I mean, I have two friends who are both opera critics, and neither of them has actually heard of this book. I mean, with the compartmentalization of artistic activity.
Well, there's a bridge there, isn't there? That's what things like London Jazz News can give, a bridge.
Well, I'm very lucky. I mean, I've been invited in. I mean, I write for another site which is called The Arts Desk, and there I get the opportunity to write about a broader range of things. And I'm writing. I mean, the guy who runs the film team likes my writing, so I've been invited. You know, I suppose you're as good as your next or last review. But at the moment, as we are speaking, I am still on the film team. I haven't upset anybody yet.
Excellent. Well, we probably ought to.
It's been fascinating.
Chattel
day. But I guess we have to wrap things up. But well, thanks very much, Seb, for joining us and answering our questions today.
It's been fun, and I've enjoyed it. And nice to welcome you here, and a really good chat, and thank you.
Probably ought to say what the website address is for our listeners.
LondonJazzNews.com. And you would not want to be without our Wednesday 8 a.m. newsletter.
Sign up to it, it's very good. And if you get no other emails in the week, it's something on Wednesday anyway.
So it's goodbye from me, Nick Tomlin.
And it's goodbye from me, Simon Whiteside. Goodbye.